This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw. Hello. Christina Wong is coming up in a moment. Before that, I want to thank those of you who donated to the show. If you've been listening to recent episodes, Amanda Ross Ho, Eric Friedenberg, and so on. I'm coming to you directly as the listener to help support this show in terms of getting new equipment for its expansion, for its evolution into its next phase. So I want to apologize to those of you who have already given money to the show, because until I get enough, I'm going to have to keep doing this. Let's just consider this our audio Kickstarter, if you will. So I'll make it brief. Please give to the show if you have not already. Even $5, $10 would be great. A little bit more would be even better. But basically, if I can get 100, better yet, 200 of you to give modest amounts, I will have enough to get the aforementioned equipment that I would like to expand the show. And I will tell you about that expansion when that gets closer to happening. Of course, if you have been on the show, you do get a free pass. I do not expect donations from guests. That said, one of my best contributions has come from a past guest. So, you know, I won't turn your money away. All right, enough of that. Thank you for indulging me. But again, please give $5 or $10 if you can. Contact me via Gmail and you can send a check via the right address. All right, so Christina Wong now. If you're a fan already, I don't have to tell you too much, although you will learn new things in the conversation. If you aren't familiar, Christina is a performance artist for all intents and purposes. There is a conversation at the beginning about what she is called or prefers to be called, the difference between a performance artist and a theater artist and an actor. By the way, this is about as close as I'll probably ever get to speaking with an actor. No offense, Christina. And we talk about that, actually. So, but I want to say more than any of that, that not since Robin O'Neill, which was a podcast that I touted highly for her sharing and her honesty, Christina really puts it out there. And in re-listening and editing the episode, I was not aware of how intense and how much Christina put on the line. You know, she drew boundaries at a certain point, as you will hear, but and it's not a slam fest as one of the popular podcasts was, but it's really intense and giving and satisfying ultimately. As I was there in person listening, I think I definitely had some of my auto defenses up, either for boundary sake or maybe more just so that I could keep tabs on what my upcoming questions would be. But in listening to it, I was very taken with how intense and generous it was. So thank you, Christina, for that. What else before we get? Oh, I almost forgot. We have a website that's live now, finally. For now, the URL is theconversationpodcast.madewithcolor.com. That's theconversationpodcast.madewithcolor.com. Go there for all of your appropriate link needs, social media, description of the show, past episodes, donation, all the RSS feeds that you need and whatnot. So go check out the site, bring in a little traffic. Thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you later. Enjoy the conversation. Ciao. Well, we were talking about the podcast that I've done and what kind of things to avoid, and you said some of the shows at a certain point fell canon. So brought up the question, after maybe how many times doing one show do you kind of feel like you're going through the motions, maybe?
I don't know.
Is Going Green the Wrong Way, that's the last show you've been doing?
Yeah.
Right? So what about with that show? How many times have you done that show?
16 times in LA, then I did about 20 shows in Scotland. What was hard about Edinburgh Fringe was we were doing shows. I only had 2 days off, so literally just running this marathon with yourself and British audiences are very their humor is so, I don't know. I watched British shows and I was just like, I don't get it. So I'm not mad that they don't seem to get me, or at least they don't seem to be jumping out of their seats, slapping their neighbors on the, you know, and And the shows always went better when there were Americans in the audience. And those are just the audiences I'm used to. These really obnoxious, like sitting cross-legged in the seats and that kind of audience. And yeah, and so it's when these shows got really quiet with really tiny audiences of less than 20 people that it became existential. I had 10:30 in the morning shows. That was my slot.
So that was your slot several days in a row?
Yeah, for the first two weeks. Then I moved to 7 o'clock, and that was even weirder because my body got so used to waking up at the crack of dawn and going through these motions and doing the show and then having the rest of the day free.
Let's set up the context a little bit because to somebody who's not a improv or performance expert but somebody vaguely familiar, the Fringe Festival is like kind of the big cream of the crop of sort of alternative theater, if you will. Is that how you put it?
I would not say cream of the crop. I would just say the crops. The crop of the all. it's a meeting of the crops because anyone can do the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and Edinburgh. You should know how to pronounce it finally after all these weeks. But
so there's a very little screening, is what you're saying?
There's no screening. Uh-huh. You just show up, and I mean, you show up, you get a venue, but the venues are not that discriminating about who gets in. There are so many venues that just about anything can go up, and just about anything does. And there are over 2,000 shows a day.
Wow.
Theater shows, which is kind of cool for theater nerds because you're like, especially here in LA, I think I get really cynical about theater because people just seem to ask me questions like, can't you just put this on YouTube or, you know, and like no one seems to value this idea of live work with the person right there and sort of the stakes of, you know, is she going to fail? Is she going to make through this?
So that's the value. That's the primary value of the Fringe Festival, is that people are passionate about it.
Well, that live. That there still is a place where theater is all over the place, and everything has been turned into a venue in Edinburgh. So it's a college town. So all the campus lecture halls are now suddenly transformed to theaters. I don't know if they're emptying out every single stage rental place, but they, you know, there are all these black curtains, and some places they don't even disguise it. Sometimes it's just the basement of a bar. That's been they've added all these folding chairs into, and bam, it's a space. And shows are going on at all hours of the day, and there are people out in the streets like trying to get you to come into their shows. And I'm not sure how many people are actually visitors or just other artists
right.
getting pushed around in shows. But I saw in the less than 3 weeks, I saw 69 shows. So. And that includes days where I just saw one or two shows. And those were light days for me. But on average, I was seeing three or four shows a day. I had to start keeping a list because I just was going to lose track. And so I decided to bring my show out there. And it was...
Did you know what you were getting yourself into?
I did. I mean, all I had ever heard was, it is crazy, it's chaotic, but you're going to love it. Don't get upset if you don't get an audience. And I was actually surprised that I was able to consistently pull in an audience. Not huge ones, but consistently pull people in. But it was just it's so overwhelming, and there's so much happening. It's like the first time I can describe, I didn't have emotions. Like, I went to Burning Man 10 years ago, and that's overwhelming as well. There's a time at night on the playa. I'm not like a big burner or anything. I had gone. And it's just like, there's so many sets of fireworks going off. So many people running around. It's just so surreal and weird. And for me, the only thing I could do was just keep sitting down and watch another show because the streets were so chaotic with people trying to pull you in. But I didn't have emotions anymore. I didn't know how I felt about anything. I was just sort of there and... It's funny because I've seen people who I met at that festival since, and they're like, you look so relaxed now. I mean, I think that is sort of the thing, that it's this complete frenzy.
Right. So one question that I anticipate that you probably aren't that interested in, but I have to ask it anyway, and that is, call yourself a performance artist? I mean, is that...
I do, and I think it's been confusing. I think performance, hardcore performance artists would not consider me performance artists. They think I'm a theater artist, and...
Right. Like a Karen Finley?
Yeah, like a Karen Finley would be like, come on, you know? Because I am talking so much.
Well, let's talk about what's the divide, because here's an interesting framing that I want to throw out that we can get into or however much or little, but... I'm interested in the dividing line between a theater artist and a performance artist. Yeah. Is that what we're talking about? And then also later, I want to kind of talk a little bit about sort of the line between a theater performer and an actor or a monologist.
Sure. Those are great questions. I haven't been asked in a long time, so I think that'll be great to to answer. We were talking earlier before we were recording about how I used to just watch stuff at Highways. And I feel like I was born a few years too late, because I feel like by the time that I got to watching stuff at Highways and catching up with all this, there was the thrill around performance art and solo work and people covering themselves in poop and blood and stuff wasn't quite there. Like, I got to hear about the NEA4 many years after in passing. Yeah. Like, the culture wars missed that in my personal history. I lived through it, but it did not affect me personally. I was at the mall, you know, running around. So, but I love this idea of interdisciplinary work. And I think also it's living in LA and claiming the word actor has sort of a negative connotation to me. And it feels very limiting. It feels like someone who realistically emulates other people or other characters. And that feels really like, so boring. And especially of late and all my shows. And this is another distinction, is that, you know, I think I am remunerated the most for my shows, which is why the shows are so prolific. But I do have a body of work that does not exist on a stage. Like this, you just noticed right here, I have the sorority binder, and you asked if I was in a sorority. I know many years ago I did a faux sorority project where it was at a community event, and I had a rush on the spot rush table for a faux sorority and interviewed people and arbitrarily picked people who to be in this or in our stupid sorority. And it was sort of me, a critique of the Asian sororities that I had witnessed, and sort of this you're in and you're out for supposed sisterhood. So I feel like performance art can sort of encompass a lot of things. I feel like, as someone who was a little bit shy coming into her artist self, what was good about claiming performance art is that not enough people knew who it was, what it was, that I was able to claim it without question and get away with quote unquote bad acting or bad writing, because it's just performance art, you know? And, the performance art
is that something you've talked to, colleagues or actors about, you know, like what your quote unquote acting is like in your performances?
Do you mean like I've described myself as a...
No. I mean, have you had casual conversations with peers, whether they be performers or actors, about, you know, what do you think of the acting in my performances? That kind of thing.
I have. And it's interesting to receive direction, at least with my last show, because it's different than the way... It's slightly different than the process of an actor who picks up material someone else has written, and it's a character that may have similarities to them but is different than them. I'm performing myself. I'm performing characters named Christina Wong of late, or, you know, even some of these really, really old shows that I've done. These personas I'm playing are still essentially Christina Wong. And that, I mean, this is what has gotten so confusing, is I've done it so much that my muscle memory of my own, like, I've this weird meta sandwich where I've performed so many versions of myself that outside the stage, it's not clear who I am. Like, it's both helping me crystallize and give power to old experiences and to be like, okay, that was that thing that happened in my past, what I put on stage. And now I don't feel so sordid and screwed up about it. But now it's like it's screwing with my memories or screwing with how I operate in day-to-day life, because I don't know.
Well, what's I'm really curious about in watching the two main performances, Wong Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Going Green the Wong Way.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, have you been able to work that, your name, into other puns?
You know, I the new show will be called Wong Street Journal.
Okay,
and,
great.
So the whole... We talked about the puns. My name worked under the show. And I actually like, people tell me all the time, you should do a show called, like, Two Wongs Make It Right, or Wong Number, as if I haven't heard all these jokes my whole life in elementary school. And so part of me does feel like a little bit of like a self-sellout, that I'm giving in to like, ha ha ha, her last name sounds like wrong or one or wall or, which is kind of what I'm playing up. But people paid attention once I started to wind my last name into a show title. My show before Wong Flew the Cuckoo's Nest was a show called Free? And it was during the Iraq War. And for me, it was like a really deep, you know, it was the deep title I had thought of. Exploring war. And are we free? Free? And it was totally confusing because people were like, is the show free? I don't know. it doesn't cost anything to come in. And so actually a friend, I just basically surveyed people as I was, I work on the grants to make shows first. So I asked people, what do you think a show about depression and suicide among Asian American women should be called? And he just threw it out. Wong Flew the Cuckoo's Nest, and I was like, done. And I thought it would be too jokey for a grant panel, because you know some of these grants can be so like uppity.
So your structure is that you secure funding before you start a show because it's going to cost a lot of money to do.
Not totally necessarily. Going Green the Wong Way was originally I actually created that with no funding. It created itself so quickly. The tours I've done subsequently, I've raised money for through crowdfunding and stuff like that, but I've not actually, and that's a really rare thing where things, you know, the momentum is just going and I'm just making the show and we're good. But the car caught on fire. I had a car that ran on vegetable oil in 2006, and it was my ambitious attempt to save the planet and get off of big oil. And then it was a nightmare. It was really expensive to repair and maintain and find oil. And in 2008, the car caught on fire, and I decided not to drive a car again. And so I started to do a slideshow. My friend Steve Silverman had this series called Slideshow in Hollywood, where just an assortment of people, creatives, comedians, writers, actors, developed digital, their digital photos into old school slides. So it's like the very first basic show and tell show, which is the living room Kodak carousel slideshow, except done with, you know, contemporary photos from your life. And I did a slideshow about this car that ran on vegetable oil, and it was a hit. The audience really loved it. And so I just kept adding to it. And the more I took the bus, it just like came really fast. Then I met Diane Meyer, who was photographing people with no car. And I was like, and sometimes I do this in my life. I'll just say, I should do a show at your gallery. And so she was so sweet. And she I think it was the closing day of her art opening, or maybe it was a photo exhibit of all these people in LA with no car and little stories of their lives next to the photos. Great photo series. And the show then was called Carless in LA. And the show did not go over as well, because people already knew, because of the context we were in, that the car had caught on fire. But when I was in a setting where people did not know me, people were like screaming at the end, because it just seems like this very naive, innocent little presentation about a vegetable car, and suddenly the car's on, there's a picture of a car on fire on the freeway, and they're like, what? So my friend Paul, who ended up directing the show, had came to the show that Diane, at Diane's, you know, gallery show, and was like, my company in Miami, he's a theater company in Miami, but he lives here in LA. We want to produce a show. And I'm like, what show? I mean, I knew I wanted to make some kind of show about it. And I was like, I don't like this Carless in LA title because it already gives away the ending. And I was just shooting my mouth, and Going Green the Wong Way came out. And so.
Right. So I saw the video version, and obviously I presume.
Yeah.
For dissemination, you know, you want to keep the thing fresh, and so you hold on to it as a you know, an entity so that it can be performed. You know, you don't make the DVD available, or you do. You do sell it?
No, I don't. Yeah. And
so it's for screening purposes, like in schools.
Yeah, I think. Well, I mean, I did shoot Wong Flew the Cuckoo's Nest as a broadcast quality DVD, and we had to, it was so much work because there were so many copyright images that we had to buy stock photo equivalent for. And even the test that I the mental health test that I referenced in that show, we had to change the name of that. Because the idea is, if, you know, we were looking forward to, like, if this was ever going to be broadcast on a station, like, all these, there'll be all these copyright issues. And you see a lot of filmmakers run into that where they use a copyright song or something like that, and it's so expensive, and they right. And they've already cut and edited it. So I had a director, producer in Mike Clausen who did all this work, and I just can't imagine with Going Green the Long Way with so much copyright music. There's images of people who I'm calling out as crooks, you know, like all the libel and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I can probably print out some DVDs and sell them at shows and stuff, but if I want to go through the lengths of like getting it,
right.
It's a great. I didn't know the documentation of that particular show. I think I sent you, did I send you the Miami one or the
LA? Miami one?
Yeah, that one. That those guys did a really good job of recording that show. And
so anyway. what I wanted to ask you, having seen the video version of it, is, and you know, people can do a little bit of research and find out your story. Uh-huh. You encapsulated basically. You wanted to, you know, be environmentally conscious. Uh-huh. You had, you know, you got a vegetable oil car and it turned into a disaster essentially. But I want to know if, you know, the takeaway ultimately is something along the lines of, you know, you have to kind of keep your idealism in check, ultimately kind of be realistic. You know, I mean, you're still car free now. You just told me you
got a scooter today.
So, I mean, but, and you know, and taking the buses, having a girlfriend who was car-free for a couple of years, uh-huh. you know, I know what a pain in the ass that is.
It is so. I'm a big pain in the ass to people. I'm also gone a lot. So I think it's that's the difference, right?
Yeah,
is like, oh, she's home and I bother him half the year. And I work, you know, most of my work is on the road. So I do admit that I'm in a very strange situation that a lot of Angelenos can't say. I'm a touring performance artist who tours a show about this. So I have to maintain this for the facade of my show, which is not totally why I'm doing it. It actually is really economically practical to not have a car that I'm not going to use half the year while I'm gone. You know, I worry sometimes that the message people get out of the show would be, well, why should we bother? Because look at all, because it's not just about the car, but it's about many attempts I've done in sustainable living. One story is how I, in high school, was looking for a summer job. And I saw this job where you could work jobs for the environment. We've all, in every major city or even small towns, have seen a jobs for the environment sign. It was for CalPERG. And they were doing a campaign, a door-to-door campaign, getting people to sign up for the Sierra Club. And you had to raise $100 at the door each day. This is when minimum wage was $5 an hour. So, or less than $5 an hour. So basically it was a 9 hour day. You had to raise $100 and you could only keep 40% of what you made in the first 100. After $100, you made $25 after that. So, I mean, it was just like, no one could really live off of that. I guess people do live off of $40 a day, but, it was really made for college kids who were home for the summer. And it was a nightmare by the end. Like, I was actually really good at it. I was the star canvasser. And I think, you know, if you look at my grant, like the grants I get and my results, I sort of have that same aggression that I had as a door-to-door canvasser then, going to that persistence. But it was very disillusioning to do so much work for the green movement. And my, you know, I think I, at the end of a whole summer, I made $1,600. Like, it was not that much money. And you think about how relatively little that was for the environmental movement. You know, it was a lot, but
so,
think about
so
all
what
the doors
is the sense that you're getting then from people who are seeing the show as far as...
I think that they can relate to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I'm getting off track. But yeah, my fear is that people come to the show and they're just like, well, why bother? You know, and she obviously
proves...
So you're
supporting
you should try.
Sort of people's kind of...
Am I supporting...
Failing rationale?
I think I take away a lot of the rah-rah-rahness of the green movement and sort of add a humanity, which is a sort of the voice of failure and the voice of I tried so hard and I'm going to still try. And I still am trying. And I just recently signed up for a freegan meetup group.
Good for you.
And there's a... I can't do it this month or December because I'm gone, but they do a bike ride and you go through dumpsters.
Right.
And you look for food that's about to be thrown out. And
that's
great. And you have a banquet. And I was thinking of volunteering, but I think I might have to wait till I do it a few times, but you know, I was like, I could volunteer my home. But I was like, I don't know how many gutter punks are going to be in this house. And actually, part of me is a little elitist and don't want these people in my house yet.
Well, that's right. But it's not necessarily gutter punks. I mean, there was actually a piece on PBS and there's a film, a documentary that I guess is sort of somewhat available, kind of like the videos of your shows, that's about this guy who sort of looked into the whole, you know, dumpster diving culture. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these people are just, you know, digging into all this untapped food that's just being tossed out by Trader Joe's and places like that.
Yeah. Know? We talked a little about my process, how I look for the money first. And what is great about that grant, as pain in the ass is the whole grant process is, and as much as people work like for weeks on these grants and they get turned away, it does force you to create a structure to articulate what you're doing and a timeline for implementation. And there are a lot of people who can't think through that and will not carry a project out. So, you know, in trying to think, okay, well, what's this new show going to be about? I decided, because so many of my last shows were so heady, I spent a lot of time with the show, so to spend a lot of time thinking about depression and suicide with Wong Flew the Cuckoo's Nest, or isolation and human connection with Cat Lady, or even the environment with Going Green the Wong Way. I've sort of, my head was spinning on itself, and so I'm really trying to challenge myself with the next few things I'm working on. I need to take on projects that force me to learn about the world outside myself, even though these things will probably inevitably be about me somehow, like the self-centered solo artist that I am. You know, at least it will be a little bit more stimulating. I think I've run out of stuff inside my head, so I must venture out. So I'm interested in exploring the global economy, and so that's what the Wong Street Journal is about, especially as someone who doesn't have things. I don't have like a Roth IRA or all these things. I've been self-employed pretty much my whole life out of college, so I don't have any money put away. And the more I look about, like, I mean, do you have these things? I don't know.
I have a Roth IRA that I got from a job, you know, that they sort of handed to me. That I had been saving, but I haven't put any money.
Well, wow.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know whether or not to trust it, because I'm like, to me, the economy, I feel like, exists sort of fictitiously. And is it possible for the economy to keep growing? Because I feel like this growth that they're measuring is not real. Does that make sense? That we're going to run out of places. Like, I feel like the rich only exist because there are poor people that exist, but we're going to either have too many poor people or we're going to run out of poor people to keep exploiting. And
right.
That's where I'm interested with this whole idea of freegans, is because they reject the idea of participating in the economy altogether, that everything we have is already here. And I'm a total clothes horse, as you can see the pile of clothes right next to you. And you know, if it's just tedious sometimes to go and look for
So that dress that you were wearing towards the end of the
which I now wear.
Did you buy that?
No, that was made by a designer and friend to the Mad Cat Theater Company in Miami, and it was all made from scraps.
Right.
And she's a pretty prominent fashion designer.
So yeah, the point is that you don't buy.
Yeah. Yeah, I have not done that. I tried that one year to do the buy nothing year, but my exception was crafts. As you can see, my sewing machine is right in front of you, because, you know, anything that would foster creativity would be okay to buy. But like things like, basically, it's no clothes, no shoes. I think no books. Yeah, I think I got everything from the library that year. And I think I did succumb. I have to buy one pair of lace gloves for some party, but you know, I realize, look at this whole closet full of clothes I have, and that we have everything we need, but for some reason, and the some reason is not some reason, it's because of we're capitalists, we have to keep selling things so that we can all keep money flowing. Like I need, you know, I benefit from it. The difference is I sell my shows and my art and stuff. So I don't know, I'm trying to, I think I am definitely at a point in my life where I'm trying to understand wealth and wealth building, but at the expense of what? And I'm interested in seeing other parts of the world. I just started to do that, not as a tourist, but more as a tourist, but you know, more rugged explorations last year when I went to Southeast Asia. And I was really fascinated, I think, because, you know, I've been exploring themes of performance and reality. just sort of the performance of the kids begging in the street and how much more effective it is for a woman to carry a baby, which probably is not hers, just like borrowed from somewhere in the village, to come up to you with this baby in her arms versus, you know, versus not. And at what point does constant, you know, are they actually, is this actually how dire the situation is as I'm witnessing it in tourist areas? Or, and is the psyche of constantly begging from white people or people who appear Western, at what point does that actually affect a greater mentality? This is sort of me thinking about things like The Secret and metaphysics. Like, at what point is that affecting this whole psychology of a nation in relation to other nations? So, I mean, these are kind of things that I've been obsessed with and thinking about lately. And I don't know that there are any clear answers that I'm going to reach very quickly, but yeah, but I'm interested.
So were you more of a, it sounds like you mentioned already you were kind of a shy kid. Was there a point where you, can you look at one sort of point where you sort of flipped over? Or are you still sort of a shy, introverted person wears a cover of extroversion?
I think I do think that I have a very shy side. There's weird things I feel very shy about telling people that I would like to sell out. It's just nobody wants me to sell. Like if I could, if someone said, you know, you could have a great career as a commercial actor, I'd say, fuck it. I'll just do it. You know, just, I don't know. Cause for some reason that seems easier than what I'm doing. And sometimes like this lifestyle can be so tedious and it's so toilsome. I look at my desk right now. This is my reality. I know it's a mess. But I see like the toil now as I step back and talk about it with someone else. 'Cause I never bring anyone up here in my work area.
But we're talking about your introversion.
My introversion. Yes. Sorry. I'm all over the place. Things keep me on topic. What was that moment? Yeah, this is going to be a pain in the ass for you to edit.
Well, what happened? No, I'm not going to edit. What happened when you were growing up? Because you kind of alluded to that in your show a little bit. Sort of exaggerated your sort of...
In which one?
Lack
one?
Of, you know, your virginity and your naivete and whatnot. What's the story?
Let's see. What is that that moment? I remember I had a creative writing exercise in sixth grade, and I, like... It just had to be like a 2-page story, and I wrote like 27 pages, and there was also like a performance we were constructing for the singing class, and it was weird because all like the privileged kids signed up for orchestra, but for some reason I signed up for general electives, and I kind of regret that I didn't do that because I would have loved to. I don't play an instrument. I would love to be able to play an instrument. And so it was just like really rough kids, right, who kind of dominated the classroom and the singing class. And I remember writing this really long narrative about San Francisco burning down to the ground and having a floating city and hoping that the singing teacher would be so impressed that she would take it, you know, take it and create a whole thing. She never did. She was like, good, like was the comment on it. Mm. But this feeling that I was destined for more than what I was bred to be, and my parents are very practical people to a fault. My mother was an accountant. She's always like, I make fun of her too because I like when people die and they're on TV, she will comment. I can see her literally doing the math in her head, subtracting her age from the people. The person who's just died and trying to figure out how many more years she has left. Like, she's very practical as an accountant. Yet people's bodies are so different. Circumstances are so different. And my father sold insurance for many years. So careful, right? Careful, cautious. So for me to be doing what I'm doing is so insane. You know, and the fact that I think that's why I work so hard at it, because I feel like I have... I grew up middle class, you know, and I grew up with a certain kind of privilege and safety. Even moving to Koreatown, it was like, God, this is so scary. And, you know, growing up, I never imagined that I would move into a neighborhood that seemed more dangerous than the neighborhood that I'm, you know, grew up in. And yet I do right now. And you know, whatever, it's been fine. But, you know, the point is that I think I just felt that I needed a breakout, that my life needed to be more than...
When you were in sixth grade, you decided that?
Sixth grade. I think because my mom would always talk about medical school and engineering school. She would cut out statistics. It was so anxious-making. She'd cut out, you know, articles for me about what people of different majors made. And I just remember thinking my major in college would be was so life-determining. And I was just like, I would flash forward, and I was like, if I became a doctor, I would be the most miserable doctor. I don't know how I could possibly keep up with all these things. I wasn't bad at math. I was okay at math, but it just math was the kind of thing that if you fell behind, you fell behind after all. You know, if you miss one principle, you weren't going to catch up two chapters later. So I don't know. I just was like, I don't think that this is my life. And I think I always. You know, I loved watching stuff like Star Search and stuff like that, and like watching comedians, and I just thought that was much more interesting.
Did you want to be famous?
I think so, absolutely. Yeah.
See, and that kind of brings us back to the sort of topic I brought up earlier, which is the divide between the performer, the theater performer, and the actor, the LA actor. So,
and it is weird because
feel sort of envy the fame of, you know, of actors?
Absolutely, because I feel like I work as hard, if not harder, and I do, you know, and for far less glory. But I also feel like, I don't know, I think part of me has this distaste of actors. It's hard to say because there's so many actor friends, but because I feel like you just, like, especially actor worship in this town. You just auditioned really well, you look good, and you got it. I mean, they will say that it was more than that. And then occasionally I will see an actor pull off a brilliant performance. It'll make me take back everything I thought and hated about actors and resented about actors. I think I sort of steered more in the performance art direction because... probably a lot of, you know, the process of making this kind of work is very psychological. It is very healing. I think acting is too for some actors. But I had a lot of issues that I needed to like figure out.
What were your issues? We haven't talked about any
of
your
issues.
Oh my
God. Okay,
that's
doctor.
What we're here for. Come on. It's only about 40 minutes in.
Sounds like therapy.
Yeah, absolutely.
God, what were so many? I mean, you
can
watch.
Well, I mean, what well, you can start.
Watch, I can allude to them and force people to buy a DVD and watch it. But Wong Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is now available on DVD on Amazon, explores a lot of my issues of feeling. And I don't know if my depression was normal when I was younger, but I definitely felt there were things that I wish could have been resolved. And in retrospect, you know, I often tease my mother. I said, if you know, had you just taken me to therapy, gotten over your issues, I wouldn't be dragging this out in front of audiences year after
year.
So you,
did you tell your parents that you were depressed and they didn't do anything about
it? When I was 11, this is the thing too. I didn't know what therapists were. They were like things that white people had and that privileged people had and had money. And to me, they were like these fairies that fixed things. Like you told them a problem and they fixed everything. And I actually have not seen a therapist in many, many years. And every experience I've had with a therapist has not been the magical fairy dust
and in ways has been
more confusing. And I think maybe because my expectations were different or maybe they're the wrong therapist. But the few times that I've, have been to a therapist when I've been in a position, I think the last time I saw it was when I had a part-time job and was able to see one for $5 a session. It ended up being a horrible experience by the end, in ways that I don't even feel comfortable talking about. But I just felt I didn't like the stigma of feeling like something was wrong with me. I just thought you know that there were other ways to work things out that didn't mean. This is where I don't feel comfortable talking about it too much, but. But I'll go into what happened is I did remember saying to my mother I'd like to see a therapist, and she didn't. And I think what broke my heart the most was not her asking what's wrong. It was her saying it costs too much money. And if anybody ever finds out you saw a therapist, you'll never get a job. And I thought that, you know, what message did that send to me at 11? It sent me the message that your emotions are not as important as your network. And to me, I'm thinking, how am I supposed to have any kind of net worth if I can't get over this depression and be a successful person? So it's so heartbreaking to describe that. But that, you know, and that is actually a reality, not just in Asian American families, but a lot of people of color. You know, there's a lot of misconceptions, there's a lot of mistrust of seeing therapists, of telling people there's something's wrong with you. It is better to hide things than show that something is, you know, than try to get better. And I think that to me is a persistent theme. And is having been, I don't know, raised or always thought that I had to show that I was perfect or that nothing was wrong. And now I just sort of let it all hang. But it's also kind of a persona. It is sort of a performance. They were carefully constructed tweets about one of my Facebook updates today was like, because my friend pointed out that, like, sometimes I, in the middle of the night, I'm like, I'm so lonely. Because it's true. I'll be on the road and I'll be like, oh my God, I'm so lonely. But at the point that it becomes like the suicide note thing, I have not done that. You know, it's sort of a loneliness that I know is still manageable, you know. And I think that's the point where I play up the sort of persona of like, oh, poor Christina on the road. And it has become sort of the show and people are very comforting about it. And it actually makes me feel a lot better to have sort of this audience around.
Like people at the show who then, give you company afterwards too?
Oh, have I hooked up with people?
Well, that or just more.
Oh, a whole bit. It's been about 8 years on the road, so a whole lot of different things. Yeah. I've met friends. I've had affairs. Of you know, one of the affairs I describe in my show, Cat Lady, and stuff. So you know, I'm not too embarrassed to share that. But you know, I I've also gone home a lot. I'm totally alone. You know, and it's like life, right?
You mean
know?
To your hotel.
Yeah, to my hotel or back to my home. So
the glory of the show doesn't carry you through the night.
Sometimes. There was one night, I think Wong Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest was like the most redeeming show for me, because it was just like all this pain, all this bullshit that I went through in college. It was like finally, it was like I'm getting paid and people are watching me, and. And what was amazing is I went through some crazy stuff in college, which is I'm not going to get into. You can watch the show and try to figure out if you can think what it might be.
Which show?
Wong Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest, and a lot of it went unresolved to me, or just felt like this weight. And I remember doing a show, and a lot of people from college were in that audience who never knew I went through all that. And when they all stood at the end, I even had an ex-boyfriend who I dated after college who came with his girlfriend to the show, and we're still good friends. And I remember I'd never done this before. It was kind of pompous and ridiculous. But they all stood after, and I got jumped off the stage, and I climbed up the aisle, and I hugged my ex-boyfriend because he had gone through so much crap with me, and it was such a beautiful thing that he was still in my life as a friend. Mm-hmm. Hugged him right in front of his girlfriend, but it wasn't like a gotcha man kind of thing. It was just like thank you for witnessing this and seeing and reading the book to the end. It was great to witness all these Bai Ling, who ended up actually being on Celebrity Rehab, was in the audience. So that was this cool thing where everyone's like, oh, Bai Ling is here. You know, like to have a famous person or infamous person there. You know, whatever you want to say. I have not read this, but apparently she's been public in some interviews about talking about her depression. So I don't know, you know, what brought her to the show, but it was cool. It was like my rock star moment. And I remember that night not being able to sleep. I remember just lying in bed going, wow, I am Christina Wong. I can't believe this. I'm Christina. And just being awake and in awe of myself. And I have had very few nights like that. But many of those nights have been around that particular show. But I think that's what was so hard to transition out of that show to do any other work, because I didn't know what was next. How could I possibly top a show where in ways I might be saving people's lives to bring this? And that's where I just fell into this total depression and was just like, I don't know what to do next. I don't know how to top this. I don't know what to do with myself. And I am alone. And I somehow doing that show, I had managed to be in every crappy relationship that, imaginable, where I just was, I mean, oh, I can't go into too many details, but I just was in with, I was just in situations that did not serve me, and I stayed in them because doing that show was so hard emotionally that I just wanted someone to be there, even if I had to literally pay them to be there.
So in other words, the intensity, what I'm getting is the intensity of some of these shows that you did, and then sort of not having somebody to kind of experience it with or have come down with was,
yeah, it was hard.
Even worse.
Well, making that show was like going out on a limb. I just, the creation period was so crazy. I went through three different directors, mostly because the initial director I worked with, Katie Pertwell, great director, but she lived in a different state, so she had her own project, so she couldn't be there at all the shows to help it along. That show was not ready when it went up. It ran over 2 hours, and I'm talking about things that were so close in my life. There's a part in the show where I have to cry on cue, and I can't cry anymore on cue. That's the transition that also happened. Is I had done the show so much that the very time, first time I did the show, I could not stop crying. And I remember looking at the audience and them and thinking to myself, they cannot tell the difference right now between me performing and me really being in trouble. And I can't tell either. And that was a really scary show to do. I was terrified about facing my family after, because as you can imagine, there's a lot of stuff there that people kind of question their parenting skills. You know, and they were great parents, I would like to say. I wish, and no parent is perfect. I wouldn't be where I am had, you know, for however you judge this situation to be, had it not been for my parents. I think sort of the, what I sometimes joke is the oppressiveness of my upbringing would not have driven me to this profession. But the tenacity to make it a profession, to be able to own a home now and to be able to be on tour half the year, would not have happened had it not been for the same parents that kind of drove me to art, you know? So I feel very blessed to have them, but it was not easy. It's such a personal work. And I think, you know, where it began to just flip for me in the course of touring it was, it became very much a performance. And I was just performing a version of myself. And I didn't know who I was anymore, right? So that's where the show Cat Lady comes in, which is this show about looking for genuine connection. It was my first ensemble show where I kind of look at my fascination with pickup artists, these men who teach workshops to men who want to be good at picking up women. A lot of the marketing revolves around get laid by women, pick them up. And I was just interested in that because I read Neil Strauss's book, The Game. That's what got me into it. And then this, I would watch this reality show on VH1 called The Pickup Artist. And I wasn't just looking at those techniques because I was, you know, judging these men. I was kind of using these techniques for myself on the road. it's not an uncommon thing. I would sit down at a restaurant and they'd have to remove the second place setting at the table. This is sort of like me on tour a lot.
Well, tell us about one maybe example of an encounter where you've tried
to pick up people.
Yeah.
Well, I think the moment that I knew that this would, the sort of surrealness came as I was so obsessed with these pickup artists. I talked to you previously that I had befriended a couple of the guys who were contestants on the reality show, and they happened to drop me off at the airport on my way to Miami, where I was doing the South Beach Comedy Festival and performing an older show. And it was everything I could. I made it, right? The South Beach Comedy Festival, sponsored by Comedy Central. I was on the same, and in the same festival as Louis C.K., Kathy Griffin. Of course, I never like bumped hands with anyone, but I just, for some reason, I was in the same festival as these people.
I was staying
at the Standard. No, I wasn't doing pickup. Staying at the Standard, had a rental car and a GPS. And every time I pulled into the Standard, the GPS would say, "You've arrived." And I was like, wow. And I was so scared. I was terrified because I was like, I don't deserve to be here. I am so scared. This is so beautiful. I have nobody to share this with. And I remember going to a nightclub by myself. And that's when I was like, just thinking, oh, I'll just meet people. And nobody was approaching me. And it was actually, I realized this is the first time I've ever really walked into a nightclub by myself. And I was thinking about this, the pickup techniques in the show. And I was thinking, okay, how can I talk to somebody? Next thing you know, this Korean guy comes up to me. And he comes at me.
Osmosis, huh?
He comes at me from an angle. And he goes, I'm looking for my friend. Have you seen him? And basically, I was so excited to see that anyone was talking to me that I just like totally was like, hi, I'm here. I'm by myself. I'm staying at the Standard. Like, I'm just like, it's like a dream for a dude, right? Like, and so it turns out he was a pickup artist. And
have you seen my friend?
Yeah. And his friend, who was his wingman, came like clockwork, like enter scene left, his scene right, you know, or whatever, stage left. And he comes and he helps. You know, but I mean, this guy was cute anyway, and I would have talked to him anyway. And once I, because I happened to be talking about pickup, because it was literally on my mind in that moment. And make a long story short, I went home with him. I've never done this before, right? At least at that point in my life, I went home with him, And the whole time, and mostly because I was just fascinated. I've been a pretty codependent person, which is kind of a weird personality for a solo performer to have, right? Or maybe not. And I went home. And the whole time I'm like, is this part of pickup? Is he being real? Is he not being real? I mean, he seems real. Because for me, it was just at that point, no one was with me. And I realized, wow, I'm having an adventure by myself. And, I mean, the whole thing was just so odd and surreal. And a part of me really got pulled in emotionally, even though I knew it was a pickup. And the next day I felt kind of sad and hurt by it. Cause I was just like, oh, that was just a show. I wasn't sure if I should feel used or not.
Were you satisfied?
Because I consented. I was, because I was like, that was such a crazy story. And then that's what began to trip me out. I was like, well, is that, because, you know, my story or show, Wong Fu the Cuckoo's Nest, is a lot about the narrative structure. And I was like, is that what good life experiences are? It are things that follow narrative structure that play out almost like movies? And what happens after the curtain falls, right? Because in real life, our lives, you know, sometimes we're at the crisis, sometimes we're at the falling action, sometimes we're back at the exposition. We go in big circles, but the way stories have been, you know, taught to us is that they follow clean narratives. The way my life was presented to me by my parents is that you will go to this high school, you're going to go to this college, you're going to get into this profession, you're going to date a good, you know, hopefully Chinese guy, then marry him, then you two will be doctors and then have babies. And that was my life. And that was supposed to equal happiness. But I knew that that was going to make me very unhappy because I was already miserable trying to be at the top of my class, you know, in high school and middle school. And I was just like, I don't like this idea that you only feel happiness at the end of the finish line. Why can't the race be happy too? And I just never was taught to just enjoy the ride. And I think finally in my 30s, I'm beginning to enjoy the ride and not have as much anxiousness about stuff. And so I think that was what was interesting about that being picked up by that pickup artist. It was such a ride and it was so enjoyed being it. It's just when it was over, I just didn't know what to do with myself again. Do I get on another ride or do I wander around the theme park? You know, but it's not even a theme park. It's it's life. So yeah, I mean, those were just some really odd, lonely years where I learned a lot. I was a late bloomer, so you know, these kind of experiences.
Yeah, because the overachieving part.
Yeah, and I also just was totally awkward. I wasn't allowed to date in college. I just didn't date. Everything had such a sacredness to it. I mean, I don't know if this makes sense, but everything, like the first time I drank, you know, like everything had a hymen to it. Like, so every first time was so important. So like, I was like, if I'm going to have a first kiss in college, I think I only kissed like one guy in college while I was in school, like in LA. And that ended so traumatically. And like, I just didn't know how to emotionally heal from things. So I was like, how do people my age go and date and sleep with lots of people when I can barely get over these little things. And so, I mean, it just took me a long time to get to where I'm now, where I'm completely jaded. Yay!
So you've got a nice thick skin now, huh?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, not really, but I think
I deal
a lot better, and I think it's because I've learned to be independent and not so afraid of things. I mean, I was really... Now I feel like I'm just crucifying my parents and my upbringing, but I do think there was a lot of unnecessary fear that I was raised around. That I really thought I just had so much terror that if I did not major in this and go into this job, I mean, it was like, here's the clear path that you can see. It's what many people have done before you, and then there's something you know, and then there's the unknown where you'll probably just die. You know, and I'm proof you don't die unless we're in some weird purgatory right now up in here in my loft. But, you know, I'm alive. I'm well. This is so great and affirming to say because I haven't talked about this in a long time. But I just feel like, if I wasn't so stuffy nose, I'd actually full out cry. But, but like, yeah, I mean, you don't fall off a cliff because you didn't become a doctor or, pursue what made sense. It is freaking scary sometimes. Like, I'm going to next year and I'm like, I don't know what's going to happen. And for me, I want to actually kind of slow down the touring so I can have new thoughts and yet new ideas in me. But stopping from what makes the money is, it creates a whole list of anxieties. Like, oh, how's the house going to get paid for? And how is this going to happen that? So yeah, I don't know.
Well, good luck, Christina.
Thank you.
Thank you for talking.
Don't leave me. Don't say the end. No.
There is no end. And good night. We're out.
That was great.
Cool.
All right. I hope that was satisfying to you as I predicted it would be, as I touted it would be. Okay, well, we're in mid-December now, and I am out of here for the rest of the month. So I want to wish you happy holidays. I hope you get a break and I hope you go somewhere or at least get a break from the day-to-day grind. And I'll be back at you next year in January with some hot new items. So, Christmas donation podcast. All right. Happy holidays and thank you for being here. I will talk to you in 2013. Ciao.